anybody know what we're listening to? Cats? No, I don't think that's it. You're listening to the Rhine River. You're listening to the Rhine River, the source of life, the source of German spirit, the bloodline of the nation, conceived in romantic terms. Natural connection, right? That sense of flowing, moving toward a future, a movement, references to the blood, and just emerging out of nowhere. It's the creation. You're actually listening to the German creation coming out of a solid single chord of E flat, which is all you heard at the very beginning. Just and then slowly and slowly the music built up, water congealed out of the spiritual essence, and it started to flow, it started to move a little bit, and it started to flow, and now it's rippling and flowing much more powerfully, right? This sense of movement taking place. This is German spiritual history captured in music, but these romantic references to the natural origins of it. And it's going to spill out here into a beautiful pool of glistening water, waterfall, let's say, and so forth. And in that pool, life forms will appear. The Ur, original creatures of the German landscape. Mermaids, fantastical creatures. Nature's not dead, nature's alive. It's alive with these figures. This is all part of the romantic vision. Nature isn't something that you dice up and dissect and kill in order to understand. It's something that you merge yourself with spiritually. And it's alive. Not the way the French see it, but the way the Germans see it. It's something that you connect with. You go out, you take your walks into the woods, and you feel yourself connected to the sky, you feel yourself connected to the mountains, you feel yourself emerging into the grass and the little world down in the, under the microscope as well, from the most tremendous to the most immediate. It's all sublime. You are awed by it. So there's this sense of just being overwhelmed and forced to forget yourself, forget your individual identity. Forget that you're alone and alienated and uncomfortable and caught up in this day-to-day existence of getting and spending. Right. So for a moment, you're awed, you're overwhelmed. But there's conflict even in the natural world. Right? There's tension. Here's the fundamental state of, let's say, a dialectical existence. Right? There are good forces and there are evil forces at work there. And what you've just heard is the entrance of evil, striving, manipulative, greedy forces, right? The forces of the dark. And that's not a mermaid, but a dwarf, who looks mysteriously Jewish under certain productions. And he is desirous of these beautiful women, these beautiful Sports Illustrated bikini-clad mermaids. It's hard to find singers who look like that, but that's the idea. Anyway, even Wagner complained about that a bit. They weren't svelte enough. And he's lustful. He's bestial and lustful. He wants them. And they reject him. They tease him. They coerce him. They seduce him. And then they say, right? You're not deserving, creature. And the dwarf, this dark side, and so forth, is infuriated and pledges itself to destroy or undermine the happiness of the these representatives of the beauty of nature, say, and reaches for the thing that they protect. And the thing that they're responsible for protecting is this, I go like this, maybe it was this, but this lump of gold, the Rhine gold, which in itself is just beautiful. But once unleashed in the world of, we'll say human, even though it's a dwarf at first, of animated activity, we'll say, is then conceived as having value, that can provide the individual with power. And that wouldn't happen if it just sat there in its wondrous natural setting. It would just be beautiful, because it's just gold, and it is beautiful, and it imitates the sun. Has that golden, shimmering quality. But once seized upon, it is brought into this world of greed, of desire, of power, and darker aspects of its spiritual force are unleashed. And that can only take place if the individual who seizes it renounces love. He has to renounce love in order to be capable of taking it. Right? So it's sort of like a King Arthur legend. You know, this only the one can pull the sword out of the stone, right, for whatever reason. Well, in this case, it has to be someone who's capable of renouncing love. And this dark creature who's been seduced to the point of passionate fury, right, and then rejected, is capable of renouncing love. So the Alberich, the dwarf, renounces love, takes the Rhine gold, off to his lair among the Nibelungen, who are the dwarves who are down there mining for iron and so on. And there he shapes the gold into a helmet that has the power of making him invisible, and into a ring that gives him the power of enough to control all those who are around him. And thus is begun the sort of industrial production practices underground, taking over the craft-like aspects of the dwarfish culture and transforming it into a kind of modern industrial process for the gain of this particular individual, rather than the good of the community as a whole, or the value of the products of craftsmanship for their own sake. There's sort of a medieval guild imagery. With this power, Alberich, the dwarf who's renounced love, is able to transform the economy into what sort of reminds one of the modern capitalist economy. This is how The Ring Cycle by Richard Wagner opens. Just those few bars that you just heard triggers a trajectory that runs over 20 hours in composed music for orchestra and for voice, which runs over four operas. This is called a prelude. He didn't even call it an opera, even though it runs 2.5 hours or something like that. And the next two run about 4 hours each, in which the impact of this transition from the original natural state into something unnatural, supposedly initiated by this darker force of nature, more sinister force of nature, unfolds. And it is an incredible thing. Wagner was a remarkable figure. I didn't mention last time, but he is treated in the middle of the book, and I had to decide whether I would open by talking a little bit about this or insert it into the middle, and it seemed more appropriate to start with some of his music and give you some of the background. But Wagner is, in some ways, the key figure in 19th century German cultural history, political cultural history. First and foremost, because he was such a remarkable and potent creator. As much as we can say about his personal life, and there's a lot to be concerned about there, there's no denying that he embodied just about every major aspect of 19th century European culture, and took it to extremes and pointed in the direction of many things that wouldn't become prevalent until the 20th century and beyond. Just a remarkable visionary in the arts. He picked up upon the whole romantic response to modernity and wove that together with a political agenda, which at first was quite left-wing, and therefore incorporated a number of the realist tendencies that we talked about last time, critical of capitalism and critical of the way especially workers' lives had been reduced to this sort of material scrapping for existence. But at the same time, tapping into what are originally romantic but increasingly modernist notions of the psyche, that there are drives and forces within that are just as important as external forces in human life, that the need to be taken account and that art needs to symbolize and represent. And he conceived of a completely new way of writing music that would suggest those forces. He jettisoned the old way to write opera, which was the Italian way, which basically was a form of entertainment in which a storyline would unfold up to a certain point with recitative or just straight acting. And then people would break out into a song, unnaturally, and then the song would end and they would go back to recitative or just straight acting and then break out into song again and so on. So it was not accurate to life, and Wagner conceived of something that would be much more seamless, that would incorporate music, text, poetry, as well as the visual arts in what he called a total work of art that would encompass all of this. But most importantly, it would use the musical commentary of the orchestra to critique what was taking place in the story, in the text, in the words. Just as, he said, the Greek chorus comments on what's going on in a Greek play. The orchestra constitutes the chorus, which is sort of observing what's going on. And what the orchestra does is register through themes, and I won't go into the whole detail of leading motifs and so on, but if you're interested, I'd be happy to answer some questions about that. I'm not expert in it, but to take themes, melodies, associate them with persons, places, things, concepts, and forces, like love, like desire, like greed, persons, places, things, individual characters like Alberich, like the Rhine Maidens, the gods that show up a little bit later, things like the gold, things like swords, things like the castle Valhalla and so on. All of those have a musical melody aligned with them, and when you hear it, if you're paying attention, you recognize that. And once he has this tapestry of motifs, of melodies, he weaves them together in the orchestra, making references back to those melodies, but transforming them each time into different keys, in a different tempi, giving them maybe a sad sound or a threatening sound or a wistful sound or a happy sound or so on, and thereby transforming them in terms of the subjective experience of the drama. So these are sort of like memories in your mind or in your soul that keep sort of re-emerging as other things are happening. Someone might be talking about love, but then the theme of Alberic renouncing love will show up down there somewhere, right? Sort of peeping out and saying, well, don't forget, love can be renounced. Right? Or someone might be talking about the wonders of the Rheingold, but then the sense of sort of sinister greed and the materialistic aspect is communicated by the orchestra by playing that same theme in a sort of dark and threatening way. So you have this sort of psychological commentary going on as the events take place. That's a simplistic way of explaining it, but it is, you know, it is an intensely modern aspect of Wagner's work, which excited even those like Thomas Mann and like Charles Baudelaire and right into the 20th century, the most cutting-edge creators of the day and beyond. Within that framework, within that representation of psychological and spiritual experience alongside the political and social events that are taking place, or even personal events, the other thing that excited modernists was the fact that Wagner paid close attention to sex. There is sensuality there. So one of the primary forces is lust, is desire, is the wish to couple, as it were. And of course, in the middle of the 19th century, even Wagner had to be rather cryptic about this. But subsequent artists who are more and more open, bursting forth, let's say, at the turn of the century with the paintings of Klimt and the Expressionists and Egon Schiele's representations of lesbianism and masturbation and all sorts of things that were completely inappropriate until the Freudian age of the first part of the 20th century commences. Wagner's perceived by them as having already made reference to the subliminal power of sexuality and sensuality in his music, especially Tristan and Isolde, but others as well. So these are all progressive, you might say, forward-looking modernist aspects of Wagner's work, which can't be denied. He was quite remarkable in all of this and many other ways. But he did tie it down to his own context with some disturbing results. Now, we have to take context into account. I mean, a person can't be beyond his or her times, and they have to respond to things that are taking place. But Wagner was... and Wagner was responding to the notion of what Germany could be and what kind of a Germany he would prefer. And his response to those problems was a shifting one. Now, after having given you that summary last time and maybe having thought about it for a couple of weeks, you can see how, you know, the individual German is constantly having to make decisions about what Germany it is, which Germany it is he or she is going to associate with. So it's not unique that Wagner had to, or adjusted and changed his mind and went through various phases and so forth. I could tell you a lot about Beethoven's politics, not as famous musicians, but just as someone we have a record of and have pored over closely, to show you how his political views changed over the revolutionary period,
from the time when he grew up in a working enlightened despotic system, and through the French Revolutionary period into a life under the Metternichian oppression. Right? His attitudes change all the time, and he's very inconsistent. So that inconsistency was fairly common among Germans, if they were paying attention to these things at all. And Wagner was inconsistent. He starts out as being a strongly strongly in support of democratic / socialist vision of a newly unified Germany, to the point where in 1848, which we've mentioned a little bit, he was directly engaged with street fighting. Even though he was the conductor of the orchestra in Dresden, he did some rabble rousing. He had appeared and organized some political events before the street fighting of 1848, and during the street fighting of 1848, it's pretty clear that he was inserting himself in a position of authority on the side of the rebels. I don't know if anyone has a smoking gun on it, but it does sound like he was at least up in a church trying to direct them where to go, and might have been involved with the torching of the Dresden Opera, where he worked. All of his associates were arrested. Many of them were put in jail for long jail terms, and a lot of others were then exiled to the United States, hence the 1848ers in the United States. But he got out. He snuck out and made it down to Switzerland and lived in exile then for the next major period in his life. But during that major period in his life, he continued to look at Germany and assess what he hoped would happen there. And what he was calling for was a kind of spiritual unity, which, in Wagner's case, would coalesce around his work. He was a megalomaniac and hyper-interested in his own fate, and he believed that the Ring Cycle would provide the central cultural experience that Germans would cohere around. That was what it was designed to do. He wanted to create a new drama, including music, in his terms, very modest, combining Shakespeare and Beethoven, and providing Germans with the equivalent of what Greek theater provided in ancient Athens. And the idea was to put on annual performances of the Ring Cycle in a sacred place, where Germans would make pilgrimages every year, and then be reminded by this music of their original unity and of their nature and all these romantic concepts of German spiritual connectedness, right? And then they would go back for the rest of their year and keep those things in mind, having learned the gospel from Wagner's work. This is more or less what he projected the Ring Cycle would provide. And there he weaves together a lot of this romantic imagery, a lot of this spiritual definition of what Germany is, which can be used for just about anything you want, depending on what your definition of Germany is, but is most effectively incorporated into a right-wing perspective of the German nation, and is tapped into by these folkish figures who were defining Germany in spiritual ways and in very large ways, crossing over borders and so on and so forth. There's a leftist dimension as well, and Wagner can be interpreted by them also, because of that rejection of gold, rejection of materials, and rejection of industrial means of production and so on. That's still there, and so he provided a little bit for everybody, and it's kind of hard to pin him down exactly. That nebulous quality is what opens up, potential audiences. So he was a genius at that. It never really, you can never really absolutely be certain what any of these figures or what any of these themes mean. Right? It's open to interpretation. And he left, again, this sort of inconsistent record of where he would stand. So that leaves a lot of possibilities, which therefore makes it very useful to a wide variety of definitions, we'll say, of what Germany is. Now, one definition or one aspect of this that is most frustrating, disturbing, and infuriating is that of the anti-Semitic imagery. And this is where a lot of attention has been drawn. I'll work backward for a moment.
Are you talking about anti-Semitism within Wagner's
music? Within Wagner's music, yeah, within his work. You may know that to this day, it is Wagner's music, certain pieces, most pieces, are banned in Israel. And the former music director in Chicago, Daniel Barenboim, has been instrumental in an effort to try to get him played in Israel and to try to have that band rescinded. So you may just know a little bit. Now that's because of the large presence of Wagnerian imagery in the history of the cultural history of the Third Reich. And the almost automatic association, especially in the minds of German Jews, of Wagner with Hitler. And that is derived from the fact that Hitler had a very, very personal and intense love and appreciation of Wagner's music, but also an intense and personal engagement with the Wagner family, some of whom, and at the time, a woman who was basically in charge of the family and in charge of the festival where the Ring Cycle was performed, were very close friends of his and supporters, financial supporters of the Nazi movement in a very early stage. Before that, there was a very strong component of right-wing, folkish, conservative lunatics who gathered around the Bayreuth world. Bayreuth is the town where Wagner ultimately landed, and the Ring Cycle and other of his works found their home. This is the pilgrimage site that he had dreamed of. It wasn't quite what he wanted, but it's what he got in a small northern town of Bavaria, Bayreuth. And the festival attracted this lunatic right-wing fringe, and they basically established themselves as the keepers of Wagner's tradition in Bayreuth. And they were vocal proponents of this folkish anti-Semitic perspective on Germany and European affairs. Okay, now going back, so we've gone from the Israeli thing to Hitler and the Nazis to the Bayreuth, so working our way backward, right? There's no question that Wagner was anti-Semitic. And he was anti-Semitic in an increasingly virulent and dangerous way, which was transforming anti-Semitism from cultural and religious anti-Semitism to racial anti-Semitism. And he was starting to think that way in the 50s, 1850s, 1860s, which is quite early in that trajectory. He was connected with racial thinkers in France, where a lot of this theory came from. I mean, the two countries from which a lot of the most important pseudo-science of racism emerged from were mid to late 19th century France and late 19th and early 20th century America. The whole all the let's say research into what we would call genetics, the influence of genetics in within this racial framework, was really coming from those two countries, which maybe you wouldn't automatically associate them with that, but that's true. The Germans were picking it up from French racists and American Southerners or other supporters of separatism, and worse, in the United States, with reference particularly in both cases, mainly to African peoples, and with some attention to Jews, but secondarily. But that language and that science and that that positivistic orientation for it, based in supposedly in fact, in genetic studies and skull facial structure, so on and so forth, was then incorporated into Germany and applied to what they perceived to be the racial problem, the Jewish problem. Now, Wagner wasn't directly involved with that kind of research, but he was aware of it. And by the end of his life, he was subscribing to that kind of an anti-Semitism. And he had put himself out there a couple of times, first anonymously, but later he had it republished under his name, so there's really no doubt about it. He wrote an article which decried the presence of Jews in the music world and argued that the Jews really can't create something themselves. All they can do is imitate. That their own musical orientation is a kind of cackling, heckling, squawking, and squeaking, which is derived from the horrible sounds of synagogue chanting and cantor singing. So it, because of that innate incapacity to create, all they can do is imitate. And some of them become very good imitators, and they can be sneaky and insinuate themselves in like Mendelssohn. So you have to watch out for them. They might be able to write something beautiful, but it doesn't have any true depth because they have no true depth, truly deep soul. It's purely superficial and imitative. Am I making you sick? Right. So page after page. But that's predicated on the by the fact that we should be able to read this because we are naturally, physically, instinctively repulsed by Jews. It doesn't have anything to do with who they are or who we are. It doesn't have anything to do with the politics or the social situation or the historical situation at all. We are naturally repulsed by Jews. Their physique, their smell, their appearance disgusts us. Sometimes we don't know it and we don't pay attention to it, but it'll creep up on us if we become more conscious. This is how he opens the essay. And that marks the articulation of this physiological identification of the other. And there's no denying that he went on record articulating this. Now there are some throwaway lines that also associate him with exterminationist, eliminationist anti-Semitism. And again, it may seem like you're splitting hairs. Is not anti-Semitism anti-Semitism, and that's bad no matter what. But we can't take people out of their context. We do need to we have to be careful a little bit about how much is the individual and how much is, you know, just sort of bad cultural habits that we pick up from our times and our period. So we do tend to give people slack in 19th century Germany if they occasionally refer to the, let's say, greed and sort of avariciousness of Jews in a whimsical or even a critical way. In other words, you sort of tell maybe tell a Jew joke about Jews in banking, or if somebody's not forthcoming with money or something like that, you might refer them to them as a Jew. Okay? Now, looking through the Holocaust, we might jump and say, oh, you know, so-and-so was clearly an anti-Semitic, and therefore should be condemned, and we need to look more closely at their career, and should they be counted among the greats? So that's one level. But then there's someone who says, well, you know, Jews are definitely a separate group. We perceive them as such, and we perceive them as, but it's in religious terms. It's in religious terms. If they convert and they start to live like we do, then we're all right with them. Well, we don't like the sound of that, right? We don't like the sound of it. But that's another level. And then there's this racial interpretation that becomes more and more common by the second half of the century, and someone like Wagner is definitely articulating that. Jews are, you can't convert. They can't convert. That's just a way for them to sort of insinuate themselves into our society. We let down our guard. We let them into our culture that way. And then, other things can take place. Well, again, that's an identification of something. They're using these scientific terms, and we're not comfortable with that. But it was quite common. All of these were quite common at the time. And it wasn't just in Germany, it was certainly in France, England, the United States, Russia. Russia's very anti-Semitic, Poland, very anti-Semitic, to this day. Right? Very much, something that you could be acculturated to think and say. Not to defend it, but then there's this step toward eliminationist anti-Semitism. And the general feeling is that wasn't around until the Nazis. But the fact is it was around in very rare cases, but it was starting to show up. This is a problem. These are the problems of our society that it's triggering. Jews are responsible for it. Try to prove it, but it doesn't really matter if you prove it or not, if you conceive it that way. The Jews are in a physiological state of opposition to us, no matter what they do. If they convert, if they try to coexist, if they imitate us, they're always going to be outsiders. Therefore, the only way to rid them and the problems that they bring about is to eliminate them. And that's the hook of racial anti-Semitism. So there's no there's no notion of progress, even if you're anti-Semitic, within that framework. And Wagner did say things like, at least according to his very anti-Semitic wife, Cosima, who may have emphasized these things more than he did. We can't be sure. She wrote down every word that the Meister said. That was her diary. Her diary was to write down everything her husband said. All you people who are anticipating marriage, keep that in mind. So she wrote down everything that the Meister said, she claimed to have said, and a few times he said things like, well, they should be all rounded up in some synagogue and burned. And that would be like in 1870s. So these are the elements that go into the discomfort that some have with Wagner's music, despite all of its creative attributes, despite the force that it had in 19th century culture. And it explains why that debate continues to this day. Now, that debate does not question whether or not Wagner was an anti-Semite, or whether or not he said these things, although there may be some questions about what Cosima recorded. But the debate focuses on the issue of whether or not the music itself, the experience of the music, the experience of the operas, is infected by his anti-Semitism. And there's the school that says, obviously, it's there. It was part of his makeup, it was part of his outlook, it became an increasingly important component of his political and social outlook. And we can definitely look at figures like Alberich in the Ring cycle and see that it is based on Jewish stereotype, right? And that other antagonistic figures in the Ring cycle and in other operas are also based on anti-Semitic stereotypes. So the enemy is usually associated in some way, physiologically, or in terms of the way they sing, and perhaps the things that they're saying, with Judaism. So those are the people who condemn him outright. It's in the music. And then the defenders, who are numerous because of the genius of Wagner's work, they don't want to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater. Right? They argue, Wagner could be a real pain in the ass, couldn't he? But he was just incredible creator and incredibly astute, and we want to be able to enjoy and explore his music for its own sake. For its own sake, and that's the key. Can music have that kind of meaning? There aren't any absolutely clear statements in the record, in his written record or in the diaries, that he was trying to represent Jewry in those figures. He didn't say that he was doing that. So it's up to conjecture. Then you have to break down the way they look, the way they're described, and their actions and so on, and decide whether or not they should be interpreted as Jewish. And it's that gap that the defenders stand on. That there's a gap there. We can't be sure. And our position is that the music stands separate and should be experienced separately and for its own sake, because it's incredibly beautiful and incredibly progressive and so forth. Others have projected that anti-Semitism on it, and therefore it was incorporated into this folkish conservative culture and Nazi culture as well. But that's not Wagner's fault, that's Hitler's fault. So they'll refer to the anti-Semitic Wagner as a reality, but as a subjective reality, and they'll call that Hitler's Wagner. That's the Wagner that Hitler and his like saw. But then there are Wagners of other people, the progressive creators who saw the sensuality and the sexuality and the psychology. There are the creators, or the leftist politics, who see the anti-capitalist, anti-materialist element, which is obviously there as well, and so forth. So they'll say, well, there are all these Wagners around, right? We reject Hitler's Wagner, right, because we don't share those views. But in doing that, we shouldn't have to throw the music out completely, because we can also draw these other messages from it as well. So we want to protect them, and we want to retain the access to this music. And that's what someone like Barenboim, to bring things sort of back to now, that's what Barenboim is arguing in Israel for the music of Wagner. So that's quite a bit on Wagner. But it's not really just on Wagner. I'm not telling you things just so you know about Wagner, because throughout this course, talking about these cultural artifacts and their significance, right, is a way of introducing you to these concepts, these themes that run through German history in the 19th and 20th centuries. So anti-Semitism, various forms of it, connection of culture and romanticism to notions of German identity, all that, right? That's what's really important about it for us. So that when you hear someone refer to Wagner, as will happen in The Loyal Subject a few pages in, right? You'll get that connection. You'll see what they mean. You'll see how that's resonating, right? This symbolic field, how that's operating. And so each of these constitutes a symbol, a set of symbols right, that cultural historians have to be aware of in order to read these documents and get that subjective sort of emotional sense of what's taking place in each of our periods.